Hello, it's Jonathan Ross, and welcome to another edition of I Like Films. This being, of course, the first I Like Films of 2019, so Happy New Year to all of you. And I'm pleased to say we've got a bunch of great names coming up over the next few weeks. But this week, we start with Academy Award-winning director Robert Zemeckis. Now, of course, Zemeckis is probably still best known for those huge hits he had in the late 80s and early 90s. Back to the Future, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Back to the Future 2 and 3, Forrest Gump, of course, various other movies that you'll think of when you think of him, Contact, What Lies Beneath, a bit of a strange kind of swerving direction, and then in 2000, Cast Away, followed by The Polar Express, Beowulf, A Christmas Carol, a bunch of movies which aren't really linked in any way, apart from A, he's involved, but also so many of them have helped push forward the use of CGI and computer technology in filmmaking. And that's one of the things that interests me most about his work, is the way that he manages to balance great storytelling with a very strongly developed commercial sensibility with what seems to me a very keen interest in moving cinema forward, in making the best use of the technology available and using films as a stepping stone to develop that technology. You can see that very clearly if you look, as I said, at Polar Express, which was kind of weird and kind of unsettling. And then the technology used in that was finessed and developed and was slightly better in Beowulf. And then in 2009, a few years after that, A Christmas Carol comes out, where it really begins to work. And so you can see what he was hoping to do earlier on. So I love his love of technology, but I also like his commercial sensibility. I was reading that when he was at film school, way back when, he didn't watch the kind of art movies and the interesting directors that so many of us associate with cinema school. Instead, he was more interested in Bond movies and Disney and commercial filmmaking. And that comes across in his work. And people often look down on those big successful movies, but I suspect they're much harder to make than movies which are more personal and smaller and aren't judged in the same way, i.e. at the box office. So he has a new movie out which opens today, Welcome to Marwen. It's starring Steve Carell, Leslie Mann, a bunch of other great actors in it. A really amazing story. It's based on a true life event, a man who was the victim of a terrible, brutal hate crime, and the way he rebuilt his life and healed himself somewhat through his art after that. I won't give too much away about it now because Zemeckis talks about it at some length, but I recommend the movie. It's certainly a film that stays with you and is, as one might expect from him, an unexpected step in a different direction. One final thing before we listen to him talking. I've got to say, he's responsible as a director for one of my favourite movies of all time. And it's one of the ones that I haven't mentioned yet, but it's Romancing the Stone, which is just about, in my opinion, the perfect rom-com. So here he is, Robert Zemeckis. Congratulations on Welcome to Marwen.
Thank you.
It's a bold film. It's an exciting film. It's a moving film. Mm-hmm. And as one expects from some of your work, of course, it also seems to be at the forefront of this kind of combination of strong acting, a great script, but with technology, with about as much as you do with CGI. And that seems to attract you.
The thing that really attracts me is stories about characters that are interesting and stories that are moving and emotional. But I think that one of the things that we can do in movies that, you know, I think that one of the filmmakers, their task is to present entertainment and present movies in a way and bring the audience to places that they can't be in real life. And so I think that, you know, I think that films can present worlds and images that you can't see in any other way. And I think that's always been part of the art form.
Is there an element, though, where when you're attracted to a story initially because of the human drama that's going to unfold and the conflict and the emotions, but is there a part of you which always thinks, where can I put CGI in here? Where can I put effects in here?
No, here's how I do it. I can tell you exactly how I do it. What I do is I say, okay, I really love this story, and, you know, this is a very interesting section of the film, which could be very visual. How can we do this in a way that's unique, something that we haven't seen before? And then I look around and say, what tools have we got? What's new? What's happening? Always, of course, hoping that it's in service of the story. That's my process. And then if it's something that's exciting, then I'll say, okay, let's try to figure out a way to make this work. And maybe it can enhance what we're trying to do, as long as I don't step too far over the line and lose sight of what I'm really trying to do in the emotional story.
Interesting that you say what tools we've got. And all the tools that we do have, and I say we, not meaning me, but right, filmmakers, right, are thanks to you. Because I get the feeling, and I don't know, I imagine this was intentional, is that looking at the arc of your kind of recent films that have used technology, this new technology in this way, it seems to me like a film like Beowulf, for example, will obviously be a story you wanted to tell. And of course, it's a magnificent story that's survived through the ages. But it's like you're using technology there as kind of version two.
Right.
Because that will get you to the technology you need for Christmas Carol, which will be 2.2 or something.
Right. And now we're here, which is, you know, like a 5.1. So I think that I would have to say that in the arc of my whole body of work, that my whole body of work has prepared me from a technical standpoint to make, Welcome to Marwen.
And so that was a deliberate move, though. That's a kind of deliberate path you've taken. Like, I will definitely take on this project because it will enable me to get to that project.
I don't have them lined up like that. So I don't, like right now, I don't know exactly what the next project is going to be. So if my next film has a situation in it where I'm going to be, needing to do performance capture, it'll be like, okay, I know exactly how to do that. Yeah. And by the way, what's happening that's new in that? What can we do to improve this? What's going on? What's new? You know, they'll say, well, we can do this, we can do that. It's the same thing with, what you would call just a regular, recorded lensed image, if you will, that isn't a virtual image. You know, you go around and say, what do we have new that we have that can help us get a very interesting shot here? And they'll say, hey, well, they have this camera now that's really small. And say, okay, well, that'll be cool. We can put this in a neat place. And it's just what I do.
Are you ever concerned, though, that there might be that moment because, and this is not me saying I felt this way during the film, but there are times in films where I felt like I'm too aware of the presence of technology. I'm too aware of the director. I'm too aware of this, the newness of this.
Yes.
And it's taking me out of the story.
Yeah, it happens all the time. I'm very aware of that, and I try not to do that. For example, You're Too Young, but back in the 1970s.
Bob, no one for a second is going to believe that.
But when they invented this thing called the Steadicam. And when they invented the Steadicam, every movie had to have a fistfight on a staircase. But now you don't even know when you're seeing a Steadicam shot because filmmakers have taken that tool. They refine the use of it, and good filmmakers will use that device and make it invisible to the viewer, which is what all technology is. But it has to go through the growing pains.
It's been absorbed into the grammar of cinema. And it was also absorbed by us as audience members, I guess, where it's no longer a startling moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's drill back into Marwen again. What was it about this man's story in particular that attracted you, that struck a chord with you?
Yes. Well, the thing that struck the chord with me was this idea that his story very vividly presented the idea of the healing power of art. That's what struck me, the idea that this man who was horribly attacked and is suffering from PTSD uses artistic expression to process what happened to him, sort it out, and heal from it. That was the germ of the idea that attracted me the most. It got me thinking about the fact that art is a universal idea that everyone can identify with because we all use artistic expression to, no matter what it is and how elaborate it is or how simple it is, to make sense of very complicated issues in life.
And you've met the man who this is based on.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, obviously, I know the documentary in part inspired you. Was this a conscious decision on his part? Was he saying, I am reaching for creativity as a way of dealing with what I've been through?
No, I think he was just doing it because he had to, and he just needed to do this. What happened to him, he was an illustrator. He drew elaborate illustrations of, I guess they were like sort of World War II graphic novels. And then when he got attacked, he lost his ability basically to use his hands, so he couldn't write his name. He had to learn how to write again. So he picked up a camera and then took these dolls and these action figures and started to create these little tableaus and take photographs of them.
I was a hell of a good artist, and now I can barely write my name. So my dolls have to tell the story.
At your service, mademoiselle.
I just moved in across the street. I love all the details. Who are they?
They are Nazis torturing Hoagie.
Why?
Because he's different. The women of Marwen protect me.
You are safe.
What strikes me as surprising about reading about this film is that it wasn't a struggle necessarily, but there was a lot of pushing that went on in the development process to finally get this made. And that surprises me, perhaps it shouldn't, with you at the helm, because whenever I've encountered directors who've had any number of huge commercial successes as well as critical successes like you have, it's surprising that you still have to go out there and pitch for a movie.
Yeah. Well, that's because the tastes of the audience have changed, you know, so rapidly. They've got so many different platforms to watch entertainment on. It's a large commitment to commit to getting out of the house, going to the theater, figuring out how, you know, scheduling your life and pulling out your wallet to pay for a movie. That takes a lot of energy nowadays. Movies that are unique and defy genre like this one does, they're not easy to market.
But I would have thought if, you know, you come in the door with something which has, and I'm please forgive me if this seems crass, but has elements that you could see might strike a chord with a Forrest Gump audience. Mm-hmm. And there are elements there of fantasy as well and beautiful design. And you know it's going to be well realized. I would think, okay, that's a pretty safe bet. It's Zemeckis. It's got a kind of like a, you know, a strange and interesting human being at the center with a massive struggle. And it's got this incredible new look to it. I would have thought that would be a no-brainer, but it took like 8 years or something to get.
Well, yeah, but I mean, a lot of that was developing the screenplay. So, but I have to say that I pitched this story to Donna Langley at Universal, and she got it immediately, and she, you know, greenlit the development of it and acquired the life rights from Mr. Hogenkamp. So she was a champion of it the whole time, but it was just a long process of getting all the elements right. We have to cast it correctly. You have to get the budget number to the right place, and all these different things have to happen. It is a risky venture nowadays to make a movie that doesn't have what is termed in the industry now a pre-sold title.
It's kind of like they call them tentpole, with the different kind of boxes you can tick.
Right. And so this is a movie that doesn't fit in any box.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's what makes it so charming and so exciting. And presumably why you wanted to do it.
All that is right. And so, hopefully the audience out there, you know, agrees with us.
Well, when I saw the trailer, I thought, well, I definitely want to see this.
Uh-huh.
So that kind of works. And that's an art in itself, I guess, getting the trailer right. And the casting, as you said, was essential. But I need, just before we move on from Mr. Hogenkamp himself, has he seen the film?
No, he sees it next week. You've seen it before him.
Wow. Yeah. Are you nervous about that?
A little bit, but I think he's going to like it. I mean, he knows everything that we're doing and, you know, has been read the screenplay and seen the materials and seen what the trailers look like and all the behind the scenes.
There was a moment in the film of kind of great power and also maybe feel massively uncomfortable, which I'm sure was intentional. And I don't want to spoil the film in advance, people, right. But I suspect you know the scene I'm talking about. The on one knee offer.
Oh yeah, no, that's a gut wrenching scene.
And was that? I'm not going to ask you this repeatedly, and you must be tired of this question. But was that based on an actual event in his life, or was that not a liberty, but was that a kind of a necessary dramatic beat that you?
No, played? That was all fictionalized.
Right.
Oh yeah.
So I'm wondering how that's going to land on him.
I don't know. You know, that's the kind of thing. You know, that's the kind of thing that there could be a curve in this that I don't know. You know, and it could be. Uncomfortable and disturbing, you know, I don't really know. I mean, it's a very emotionally uncomfortable moment in the movie, but that's to the credit of my cast because they just did it so brilliantly. Yeah. And it's really heartbreaking. And it speaks to the character's loneliness and it speaks to his struggle.
Deja Thois.
Yes.
Did he have in real life a character called Deja Thois, or was that you? Are you an Edgar Rice Burroughs fan?
No, Deja Thois is very, very much in the real realm of Mark Hogenkamp's doll world. I took liberties with her. Again, I don't want to give away the plot of the movie, but she's a bit different in the movie than she is in the real presentation in his real realm.
My ears really pricked up because I'm a huge Edgar Rice Burroughs fan. We should point out, people who don't know, Deja Thois is the princess in John Carter of Mars series. And, and it really kind of came alive for me. There's another moment, though, where I felt there was a... And your work is often filled with pop culture references, but now you've got to the stage in your career, Bob, where you can pop culture reference yourself, of course, many times over. I mean, you know, it must be sometimes, I'm sure, a trip to the cinema for you where you see a Castaways joke or a Back to the Future joke or a Forrest Gump joke, which are many.
Oh,
it
yeah.
must be a peculiar
right.
experience.
No, I was on a talk show yesterday in Paris, and they... And they were talking about the predictions that Back to the Future 2 made. And of course, they ended with the one that, and of course, you know, you guys predicted that, you know, Donald Trump would be the president of the United States.
So it's your fault.
Yeah, it's our fault. So there, that was the joke, actually.
There is a Back to the Future reference in here.
Which there is. So here, yeah. So, you know, so there comes a point in the story where, you know, Mark, our hero, has to, is ordered by Deja Thoris to build a time machine. So when I was writing that, I was thinking, okay, so now what do I do? And I thought, well, you know what? If I walked out into the street and asked people at random what a time machine looks like, I would expect that the majority of them would say it looks like a flying car.
A DeLorean, yeah.
A DeLorean, right. Yeah. So I thought, well, that's probably the way Mark would see it as well.
Yeah.
And so I just went with it.
Is that strange to you at all, though, to know that you have informed an imaginative idea, that, you know, you have had that effect on the kind of consciousness, the zeitgeist of the world?
I don't think about it a lot. You know, it's wonderful. I'm thrilled and astounded that the Back to the Future movies have been popular for so many generations. I don't know why. I mean, that would be, you know, something that scholars should try to figure out more than the filmmaker. But I think that what Bob Gale and I stumbled on when we made that series was this universal fantasy, this idea of what it would be like to see what your parents would look like when they were your age, and, you know, or a teenager, as it
when
is.
And they were stumbling towards adulthood.
And they're stumbling toward, yeah, yeah, stumbling toward adulthood, because it's, and I think that might be, that's a timeless idea.
There are so many variables, it seems to me, in that process, in that filmmaking process.
Right.
That's what makes it so challenging. How long after a film's out can you be objective about it? How long after movies?
Yeah, I don't, you know, yeah, out? Okay. Well, you know, I actually don't go out of my way to watch films, you know, after I make them. Once in a while, I'll, you know, just sort of be surfing through what's on cable TV or something, and one of my films will be on it, and I'll just watch it, and, you know, and then there's some time that goes by, and it's, you know, it's kind of enjoyable.
And you, so can you enjoy it now without the stress of making it, without the kind of pressure, without knowing that decision was made because we had to make that decision?
Yeah, well, here's the problem with being a filmmaker. The problem with being a filmmaker is you can never see your work objectively ever. You know, I have a fantasy that it would be fun to make a film, hire a hypnotist, be given a post-hypnotic suggestion that erases all memory I have of making the film, but I remember everything else. Sit in the theater, watch the movie, write down some notes, and then be taken out of I think that would be fascinating. I'll never be able to see a film that I make the way you know, an audience sees the movie for the first time.
Bob, I believe heavy drinking has that effect as well.
I couldn't.
Okay, let's talk about some of the other films that appeared. There's one film which obsessed is the wrong word, but I just am very enamored with, and a remarkable story behind it as well, which is Romancing the Stone.
Yeah.
Very early. Probably your first big hit, I guess. Would that be fair?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And I'm interested in the screenplay, Diane Thomas.
Right.
Diane Thomas, who of course tragically died shortly afterwards.
A terrible car accident. Yeah.
I mean, that screenplay is about as close to a perfect screenplay as you could get, I would think.
It's pretty, yeah, it's really, really good. I mean, you know, that was a lot of work and heavy lifting on that screenplay. I mean, there wasn't a screenplay, when I read the first screenplay, it was a bit crippled. It wasn't the final movie. I sat with Diane and I said, you know, I think if we really work on this together, that we can really make it into a razor sharp movie. And she was brilliant and game, and she just dove in, and, you know, she worked on it diligently. She had that romantic story was in her DNA, and she kept that close. And that's what kept that film, I think, is what makes that film work so well.
Let me ask you about screenplays that don't necessarily work when they're transferred screen. Let me ask you about 1941.
Yeah.
It's by no means Ishtar, but it's certainly seen as a movie which had the potential to be, and the expectation was enormous, and then it didn't click. And do you think it was just, I mean, well, why do you think it didn't work for the audience?
I think what happened on that movie, having been there, is that we wrote too much. Other elements kept coming in and bending the initial germ of the idea into different places. For example, the character that John Belushi plays, this crazed pilot. In our first draft of the screenplay, all this mayhem was going on. This plane lands on Hollywood Boulevard on page 60, right? But then what happens in sometimes, and happened in this situation, is Now you cast somebody like John Belushi, and it's like, oh, we got to put more of him in the movie.
And he could have been hotter then.
He was as hot as you could be, and he signed on to do the movie, and he was, you know, doing this wild character. And so those scenes were invented. They weren't organic, and it kind of just kind of gets out of balance, and we end up, you know, with a movie that isn't as tightly written and as it could have been or should have been.
And it's peculiar, though, because the audience kind of senses it. When I'm watching a film, there's sort of subconscious interaction with the film, and afterwards you realize it's because that story works so perfectly. It was like a diamond where everything supports everything else and everything's in the right place. And you kind of know that even without knowing it.
Right. Yeah, I think the way I like to describe it is I think the audience absolutely is subconscious, but they adore it when they feel that someone's driving the train. Mm. You know, when you're in a film and you get it, you know, you kind of think, okay, I think this film may, you know, you don't think of these things. It's a feeling, you know, you're not conscious of it, but you're thinking, wow, I think I'm in good hands here. I think this filmmaker, and you know, is going to do right by me. And he's not going to go off the rails here.
Yeah. And speaking of the rails, let's talk about Polar Express a bit, because an enormous hit.
Yep.
But once again, the technology wasn't quite there in some ways, was it? There was that kind of slightly uncanny valley effect going on in the eyes at times.
We did something totally new and totally unique, and you know, we just didn't have the wherewithal. We were building the new technology. I mean, it's interesting. I was thinking about this the other day when I was talking to a journalist about what I just did in Welcome to Marwen. And I've never been a fan of, you know, there's some filmmakers who go back into their old movies and change them, we've seen
George,
that happen.
George has done that with some of the Star Wars.
Exactly. He's done some of the Star Wars. But I was thinking, you know what, I wonder what would happen if we went back into Polar Express with what the tools I have now and just reshot those close-ups.
Yeah, because it was the close-ups really that presented the barrier to me to engage with the film.
Yeah, we created this new form of filmmaking, which is called performance capture, but we were making it up as we went, and we didn't have it completely drilled down. We made the movie too early, too much in front of the technology. People still love it, it's a perennial. It's played every Christmas.
Yeah. I'd happily watch it again, but then when you go into Christmas Carol that you did with, I think was there similar techniques in that?
Exactly, but not the same. Okay. Yeah.
A world of difference.
Yeah. And then now look at Marwen.
Yeah. I mean, it couldn't be more.
Yeah. So it's getting there. It's almost perfected. And it's going to be a very important tool, I think.
But Bob, why do you make life so hard for yourself?
I don't know. I probably should stop.
Because Roger Rabbit, when you did Roger Rabbit, that was an extraordinary adventure.
Yeah, that was really crazy.
But that would have broken most people.
Yeah, that was just nothing but back-breaking work. Yeah, that was.
And that was, you were using more traditional sort of cell animation, weren't you?
Yeah, all hand-drawn.
Amazing.
We had no computers back then.
Wow.
Right, yeah.
But a great film.
Yeah, that one turned out really well.
Do you apply that kind of critical focus on your work? Do you look back and think, okay, that's a great film, that's not a great film? Or are you so aware of the compromises or the difficulties and the variables that went into making it that you don't have that?
Unfortunately, I don't know if all filmmakers do this, but I always see the blemishes.
Well, that's not a good thing. You said fortunately.
I said unfortunately.
Oh, good.
I said, no, unfortunately.
Well, you swallowed the arm. I think that was subconscious.
No, I unfortunately only see the blemishes. But
when you look at a film like Castaway, what blemishes do you see there? Because that seems pretty blemish-free to me.
Yeah, no, that's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful performance by Tom in that movie. And that movie has very few blemishes.
Yeah,
very few blemishes.
The opening crash sequence of that, there's no surprise, remarkably powerful, very visceral. You seem to enjoy that. Because even in Marwen, there's a moment at the beginning when some explosions first go off, and it's like, I jumped.
Right.
And I'm an old man who's seen a lot of films, Bob. That's, it takes some doing to get me to jump.
Right.
Do you you seek those kind of moments out? You know that's going to be a linchpin for the film?
One of the things that makes films entertaining is you got to keep the audience a little bit off base. You got to throw them some curves and things that they're not expecting.
There's a saying, of course, that you don't really know someone until you've walked a mile in their shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Mark famously, and as is brought to life in your latest movie, wears women's shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Did you indulge to get yourself into the right frame of mind?
No, I haven't. No,
no heels?
No, I don't have any. I have
no, I'm not saying do you own any.
I think maybe I did. They're impossible to walk in.
I know. It's no wonder people are turning their back on them.
Yeah, no, it's impossible to walk in.
But you tried.
I had to, because I had to encourage. I had to encourage Steve, who had to really train. But they look great.
They look amazing. This is the thing. But we don't wear them through choice.
We don't wear them. But if you read the history, high heels were invented and worn by men.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I happen to know this because I had. Yeah, this is the one. Well, this is one of the fun aspects of being a filmmaker. You learn all this stuff that you can regale people at dinner parties with. High heel was invented to lock the man's foot into the on a horse, into the stirrup. Back in the day, men wore stockings, and it made their calf look a little bit. They made their calf look good.
Yeah, and your, as you would say in America, your butt.
Yeah,
wonderful thing for that.
It does that. So they were a fashion statement that men wore. Then they were. It became a fashion accessory for women
around
the 1800s.
While you're in town, if you want to kick back for an evening, just in a private room with me, we'll put some stockings on, some heels, and we'll just relax, okay?
No
judgment. Let me ask you about Death Becomes Her, because I adore that movie. Mm-hmm. And yet that didn't click, did it, when it first came out with the public particularly?
Yeah, it was, the public has a very hard, I don't think it's that, the Americans have a very hard time understanding the genre of dark comedy. I love it. It's almost like the mass audience doesn't really understand it. You know, they just don't understand the deliciousness of dark humor.
Big hit with drag queens.
Apparently it is, it's become almost like a rave film in that regard.
Yeah.
It's kind of become like a Rocky Horror Picture Shows.
It's that dark thing. Glamour.
It's that dark glamour, exactly. And all these people dress up like the characters, and they show up at the theater, and they know the lines, and they talk along with the movie. It's wild.
You know, we were talking earlier about the kind of healing power of creativity. And I'm curious, if you weren't enabled to make movies with a budget, with a cast like this, would you still be making films? Would you be doing what Mark does in the film? Would you be out there with your phone, catching moments and splicing them together?
I hope so. I would have to do something. Listen, when I hear you, you know, ask a question like that, I immediately go to, you know, a profound sense of gratitude that I've been able to do what I've been able to do in my life. And, you know, I just go to that place. But I really don't know, but I would hope I would find a way to always be able to kind of work in this sort of moving image medium that I love so much.
If one was to look at your work and compare it to other, what I consider, you know, massively successful commercial filmmakers, Spielberg, not Lucas necessarily, but Scorsese perhaps, it would be, superficially at least, it would be easy to see that there was a period where you make crowd-pleasing movies, which are, you know, huge events, and then gradually move on to slightly more interesting, slightly more challenging ideas. Do you think, is that a maturity thing? Is that just kind of an evolution which is inevitable, do you think?
I think so, probably. I mean, I don't think I would be able to sit down and write 1941 today. I think it's just probably a byproduct of maturing, of aging. One of the things that I feel I'm very fortunate to be able to have done in my career is I've been able to do such a diverse body of work.
It's very hard to know what you're going to do next. Always.
Yeah, it's like I was so glad that I didn't just have to do the same genre type film, and I was able to just do so many different subjects.
The only time when you really repeated yourself, and of course it wasn't a double repeat, was going from Back to the Future back to number 2 and 3, which I believe you shot back to back. Now, was that pleasurable for you, or was that something that you would choose to avoid?
Okay, well, all right. So the true story there is that I, you know, Bob Gale and I were, you know, we were very arrogant. The reason that we made Back to the Future 1 and the fact that he went back to the past is that it was relatable. I had a very strong attitude about that, an arrogance about that.
Well, confidence. Let's say confidence.
And I didn't think that going to the future ever worked in films. The only guy who ever really did it, in my opinion, back then was Stanley Kubrick, who did it really well. But even he didn't have a computer, in the future. So anyway, a desktop.
Yeah, it's not going to be recognizably the future when we arrive in the future.
Right, and so, you know, what happens is that when anyone tries to predict the future, They always underestimate it.
And it dates the film terribly in years to come.
And it dates the film, and it dates the film. So what happened, ironically, is that Back to the Future became this giant hit, and it became this piece of corporate real estate.
Mm.
And, you know, we were sat down by the heads of the studio, and they said, look, fellas, we're going to make a sequel.
Whether you like it or not.
Yeah, so you can either be part of it or not.
And do you?
And so we said, well, okay, well, we'll go on board. Bob and I sat around and said, so how are we going to do the future, right? How are we ever going to present the future that is going to work? And we said, you know what? Let's just make everything a joke.
But it was fun. And you know what? By the way, this might sound like I'm being dismissive, but I'm not. I loved the theme park ride that came out of that.
Right.
Yeah,
oh, that was really great.
That was a great ride.
It was a good ride. And I think they still have it at the park in Florida.
And presumably you oversaw that. I know you shot the movie for it, but presumably you oversaw the, were you involved?
Ride on the ride?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's great. I would take my family. I mean, it was one of the best motion-based rides that was ever, that was ever made.
Well, they used the same framework for the Simpsons ride later on. They just kept the same building, didn't they?
Right, they did. But what they could have done is they could have kept just changing the Back to the Future adventure. But anyway, those motion-based rides are a lot of fun.
You know, you mentioned Polar Express, and you said there's occasionally you're tempted to go back with the technology you have today and fix those eyes. Are you going to do that?
No, I don't think so. I'll call the head of the studio and see what he says.
There must be a young Bob Zemeckis out there who's desperate to cut his teeth. You say, let's give it to that kid.
Yeah, well, I'd have to get Tom Hanks. You know, he played all four characters in the movie, including the boy. So I'd have to get him to agree to do that. I don't know if he would or not.
Tom's not going to refuse your offer there.
Well, there's nothing more difficult than to have to reshoot something. It's painful for everybody. Back in the days when we had film, we were endlessly going back to reshoot wonderful stuff that we had shot the first time around because the film would have gotten scratched. It would have gotten destroyed in the lab. We have all these problems that you couldn't see until 24 hours later. And it's always miserable having to have to do that.
So why do that to yourself? Yeah.
Why do that to ourselves? Yeah. Right.
But exactly. I tell you what, for the children, Bob.
right, exactly.
For people like me who wanted to lose themselves in that but found those creepy eyes too off-putting. do you have is there one of your movies which you look at with more pride than the others, with more kind of joy, with more kind of appreciation of what you achieve?
It's a tough question because, you know, it's like asking which of their children do they love the most. Of course, you can't answer. You love them
all. You know the answer. You just don't say it out loud.
Yeah, you don't know. Yeah, you love them all. You love them for different reasons. I mean, but, you know, I'm really proud of Welcome to Marwen.
It's genuinely thought-provoking, and it's also moving, it's touching, and just beautiful use of state-of-the-art technology.
Right.
I hope it's a commercial success. We were talking earlier about variety of films and genres and types that you have approached in your career, and I guess there are a few that you haven't. Not many, but I mean, I don't think you've done a crime thriller,
like a noir crime film. Yeah. A little bit of it's in Roger Rabbit.
Roger Rabbit's
a little noir. I haven't done a musical, but I have music and dancing in almost all of my movies.
Yeah, and there's a lot used beautifully in Marwen. So a musical, would that be on the cards for you at some stage?
Yeah, well, that's a genre that I think was perfected by the movie Cabaret.
Oh, amazing.
And it hasn't really, it's a tough one. Now, Les Mis was a big hit, and, you know, the audience has embraced that movie.
But Les Mis, which was, you know, it was glorious in its way, but I think the songs are so powerful and crowd-pleasing, and that isn't a dismissive thing, but also the emotional heft of that story.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Cabaret felt to me like art.
Yeah, well, that was, I mean, it was so beautifully designed to, you know,
Was it Fosse?
Bob Fosse and the... And the actual performances and the presentation of the dance and the music was so organic to the story, it was breathtaking.
And of course, Fosse comes from that choreography background, therefore, and being a dancer himself. So maybe that's what helped inform that level of skill.
Right. But yeah, that's one genre that I haven't been able to find a story for yet.
But you're looking.
Always looking, but not actively. I'm not out there putting out the word, find me a musical. Hopefully at some point.
I want to dance. I want to sing.
right, exactly.
Bob, can I ask you, how old are you?
I am 67.
Still enthused about filmmaking.
Yes.
Still engaged with new technology in a way which is quite unusual for, and I'm not going to say advanced years, but
let's say
an older middle-aged man.
Yeah.
Yeah. The new, because now we expect to live to 100. So you're still in the middle chunk.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll take that. I still love getting up at 4 a.m. and going out to make these movies. If that leaves, then I don't think I should continue. You know, I gotta be excited about it. It's too much hard work to not love it.
But without wishing to blow smoke up your backside, mm-hmm. that comes across. And that is one of the reasons why I look forward to your films. And even the ones which I think, you know, where right. I've come away thinking, oh, that didn't click with me as much as right. others. Sure. Still, I sense there's a desire to entertain and to move and to create something which hasn't been seen before.
That's how I enter every project, you know.
I mean, with technology going, in medical technology going the way that is, you might live to 150.
You never know.
Maybe there'll be a CGI version of you directing a CGI version of Tom Hanks for us in another 70 years' time.
Yeah, well, when we have these conversations, you know, us guys who are, how did you describe it? Advanced in our year. What did you say?
I think a late middle-aged or late middle-aged. Yeah.
So when I sit around with, you know, with like Steven, you know, we say, well, listen, we're going to take our cues from Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
You know,
still going.
Clint is still doing it. And, you know, then that's. And we're going to just follow.
And still pushing right. for something new, still trying to stretch himself.
Exactly.
Bob,
exactly.
A great pleasure to spend time with you. Thank you so much for giving
us
this time.
Appreciate it.
And I'm looking forward to seeing whatever you do next.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
That musical is going to be a huge hit.
That would be fun.
So that was me chatting with director Robert Zemeckis. I hope you enjoyed it. As I said earlier, his film, Welcome to Marwen, is out in cinemas today. And the film that inspired that for him, which was based on the true story that is at the heart of both of them, is called Marwen Cole. And I recommend that very highly as well. You can find it on most of the streaming platforms. I watched it on iTunes, but I'm sure you can find it all over the place. You'll notice there's some music going on in the background now. I'm a big collector of and listener to of film scores, but this isn't film music per se. This is something I was quite excited about. I thought I'd share it with you. I love the work of KPM Studios. KPM was a music library that made music that could be used in commercials and backgrounds on television and so on. And as a Christmas present to myself, I bought from another collector an enormous box full of KPM albums, including scores like the one you're listening to in the background, which is from Contact, progressive themes and underscores reflecting optimism and enterprise. And this track's called Advanced Report. It has nothing to do with this week's podcast. I just wanted to share it with you. So thank you to Mr. Robert Zemeckis for giving so generously of his time, and to Helen at Universal and Stephanie at Cameo for helping to sort this one out. In coming weeks, I'll be talking to M. Night Shyamalan and Samuel L. Jackson. We're going to do two separate shows with them, but they're working together on a new exciting movie, which I'm sure you probably know a little bit about if you liked Unbreakable and Split. And this is the third in that very kind of long-running, I would say, stretched-out trilogy, but I'm looking forward to speaking to both of them. Ken Loach is coming up as well, and a bunch of other people. If you enjoyed the podcast, then please do subscribe and keep listening to them. And maybe tell your friends, tell your elderly relatives, tell your pets, tell anyone who's available. Because, you know, the more people who listen, the more we'll do. Okay, thanks. Bye.